Make your next move with a beautiful website from our sponsor, Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianBooks to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week we're going to plunge into fiction in translation and find out what the world looks like for both adults and young people when it's viewed through the eyes of writers from different cultures writing in different languages. It's a widely quoted badge of national shame that only 3% of books published in the UK are in translation. I'm joined in the studio by two people who are doing their utmost to shift the goalposts. Daniel Hahn is a translator, the compiler of an anthology of children's stories from the best European writers aged under 40, and a judge of this year's Man Booker International Prize, the long list of which has just been announced. Daniel, let's start with the Man Booker. Tell us what long list means and how did you arrive at it?
So the long list is the 13 books out of the 126 submitted books, the 13 books that the judges thought were the best works written in English in translation. So they've been written in some other language, but what we're comparing is these books in English. So we read 126 translated novels. That number is kind of seared on my brain now. Having read those 126, we, over many judging meetings, we chose the 13 that we thought were the best. They worked the best as novels in English, if you like.
So that's 13 novels from 11 different countries, and we're going to park that now. Richard, you have interviewed one of these writers, whose daughter Nors, who is from Denmark. Why did you choose to interview her?
Well, it's just a great voice, really. I mean, it's the book is about a very quiet woman facing a kind of a moment of explosion in her life, and we don't hear very much from quiet women. And daughter Nors, she speaks very well about it, and it's just a fascinating novel.
And it's Mirror Shoulder Signal, and let's hear from her now.
A trail leads into the grain, is rye. The rye extends high overhead. A few stalks have fallen across the trail, a secret trail that started as a tractor's wheel track. A foot could feel its way forward, and hers did. Afterward, it was a matter of following the rye. You were only supposed to go where it was already bent. If you kept only to those places, you could make a trail so concealed it almost couldn't be seen. In time, perhaps, you could bend a few more stalks, make the trail into a path, and then find your way in deep into the field of rye. The ears of rye have long bristles. The joints sit so high on the stalks that the ears get in your face, and then, at the bottom, the sandy soil. The soil's hard and almost stony and easy to walk on. One yellow clog after the other. The canteen of juice drinks stuffed into her waistband, and Sonia circles around in the rye like a field mouse. She's made the path herself, and it took her some time. Above her, the sky is endless. The clouds puff upwards. The buzzard hangs and quivers. It can hover in the air like a helicopter, and it hangs there with its gaze on the ground. Only its outermost wingtips tremble, and at intervals it straightens its wings. The buzzard hangs like a sketch over Sonia, who's on her way to the hidey hole. The hidey hole's a trampled-down lair where the rains knock down a patch of vegetation. Even the combine couldn't lift the stalks there, and Sonia seats herself in the hidey hole. The well beyond disappears, and Sonia sits there cross-legged like a tailor. She's pushed off the yellow clog so that she sits in stocking feet. Then she digs out the canteen, and the smell of sweet grain settles around her. She feels like she could actually sing a song right now, a short one, if it weren't that Dad would be able to hear, and she's not supposed to be in the field. The rye's there to harvest, each stalk a part of the crop. The only time kids are permitted in the field is when they're supposed to find wild oats. The devil made wild oats, Dad says, even though he doesn't believe in such things. And the wild oats must be rooted out, or else they'll sow strife with the neighbors. Marie's father in particular has a problem with weed seeds, and kids are the right height, especially when the fields are planted in barley. The bells of the oats dangle above the barley, and Sonia moves like a shark through the surface of grain. Dad walks hunched over behind Sonia because her sight is good. She can spot wild oats from one end of the barley field to the other, and then she calls out, "Look, Dad, there!" Dad tiptoes like that ballet dancer Sonia's seen on television, in through the grain. Every stalk is money, and it's as if the wild oats might escape. Snap, and he's got it. Root and all. And he places it carefully in the sack. Then he smiles at Sonia. It's a species of happiness. And once, when they'd come out of the barley, he said, "You're so clever." And Sonia said, "I'm like a little field mouse." And then he placed his warm hand on her head.
A 40-something woman who isn't defined by her relationship to a man or to her children is something of a rarity in much fiction. Did you have that gap in your sights when you started the novel?
Yes, I have been for like the three last books I've written, been pretty preoccupied with the woman as a being on her own, as a being that is not defined by her relationships or motherhood or all these things, but as a being in herself, which is pretty interesting to discover what existence as a female is when all these things are removed from her.
And is that because it's territory for you to acquire because nobody else is doing it, or is that because you feel that it's something that is a subject very dear to your heart?
I think somebody else has been doing it, but in earlier times, men would be doing it. I remember there's a quite famous novel in Denmark called A Woman Around 40, written by a man. And I read that book and I thought, nah, I mean, you know, you have to get that from within. You know, there's a vibrance in that from within that you have to get. And also, I think in these days, there are more and more women living on their own, and women, at least in the Western world, we have the... We can choose for ourselves how we want to live. And that also leads to much more women living without children or living on their own and having careers and trying to figure out what kind of role that is in life, to be in the world, not because of that you have to have children or be somebody's wife, but because you are here. And all my literature is circling around existential structures. I'm completely preoccupied with figuring out how the existence behaves under pressure or under different kinds of circumstances. All my books are about that. And this is interesting to actually observe a gender in that particular existential situation.
By existential structures, you mean an existence and how that existence matches with the world around it?
Yes, and in this case, we have a woman around 40. She has no children. She has no strings attached. She's living in a big city. But also she has at that point in her life where am I going from here? What is the future for me? And where did I come from? And can I ever return to the place where I come from? Which you can't. This is an existential structure, right? The time is sort of being a problem to her. And she's paralyzed. She can't move forward and she can't move backwards. So she's sort of portrayed in that situation where there's the life that she was supposed to plan for herself, which women are. We are supposed to plan a life of children and family life. And that future is not there anymore, and the one she came from has disappeared also. So that's a pretty interesting place to observe people when they're paralyzed.
Because she keeps returning to her childhood and thinking about the way forward. She's caught in this position in the middle where she's stuck, as you say.
She's stuck. She's like she's driven her life, her being, into a blind alley. She can't keep on going down that road. She has to figure a way out of it.
She has to change gear.
She has to change gear and direction and become a master of her own being, to come in command or demand of her own being. And I think that is sometimes something that quite often happens for women when they're in midlife, that they suddenly figure out, oh my God, I'm not driving the car myself. I might be driving the physical car, but I'm not actually the master of my own fate.
And for Sonia, I mean, the metaphor is very concrete. She decides to learn to drive. She wants to do something about it. So even though she's in this place, even though she's stuck, she wants to find a way out. And the way out she chooses is by learning to drive.
Yes, but also because I'm so incredibly interested in these existential stuff. I mean, driving car lessons is very existential because in order to survive these driving lessons, you actually have to deposit your free will with the driving instructor. And he might not be a nice person, or she might not be a nice person. So the whole thing about having a grown-up individual having, you know, sort of deposited everything in another person became pretty funny to write about also.
And because she has to follow the directions of the instructor.
Yeah, she's no longer deciding her own geography, for instance. She doesn't know where she's driving. She just drives where the instructor tells her to. And this entire battle is also about, you know, to become in control of your own life and to decide your own life and to take responsibility. The reason why you deposit your free will with the driving instructor is because otherwise you will kill someone. I mean, you basically will. You'll be an assassinate, you know? So
you have to give up control in order to assert yourself.
Yes. Hmm. And to put a grown-up person in that situation, it's pretty hilarious.
About halfway through the book, Sonia remembers a time from her childhood when some piglets escaped. Mm-hmm. They got into the feed concentrate and died because they'd eaten too much. Mm-hmm. Has Sonia, like the piglets, been swallowing it all for too long? Is she on the point of an explosion?
That's a very good point. And I do think there is something in that metaphor that talks about that. And also in Denmark, and probably also here, young people are being told to urbanize themselves. There's if you climb up the ladder to the urban life, you get status, and that is the true life to live. And that is equivalent to overeating, because not all people can actually take in all the urban stuff without exploding. And she's been overeating on urban life, I think. She's full.
And this is why you've chosen to set the book at this point, where she's stuck. She's trying to move on, but she's on this point of an explosion of some sort.
Exactly. And then in modern life, it's also like this, that if you're a grown-up, well-educated person, it's pretty hard to take yourself out of the city. Because where are you going to get a job? Because all the jobs have left the provincial areas and the rural areas. So you're actually in some sort of existential jail where you can't choose another life for yourself, because this is how you make your money, living in the city. But another life, the life that you were sort of deported from, might have been better for you.
It's tempting to draw parallels between Sonia and yourself. I mean, you're both born in Jutland. You're both translators of crime fiction. Mm-hmm. Was it something that you've drawn from your own life?
I think most writers use material from their own life, and those who claim that they don't are lying, you know. And of course I do that. I donate stuff to give my writing life and presence. I mean, literature without presence is incredibly boring, and in order to have presence in a text, you have to donate and give something of yourself. That is not the same as the whole story being autofiction. I mean, there's a sister in this book that Sonia has problems with, who stayed back home in the rural areas. And people come up to me after readings and they go, "What does your sister feel about you writing about this?" And I go, "Oh, I only have older brothers, so there's no sister." So it's not like, it's not a one-to-one thing. But I have donated a lot.
And it's using elements of the feeling that she feels. That comes from a moment in your own life, does it?
Yes, it was. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say I'm 46, but like, you know, some years ago, I was in that position where I thought, where is life going to take me and what can I choose from now on? And why is it hard? Why is this a hard moment in the life of a woman? And it is because you have to sort of decide for yourself. You have to grow up with your decisions and figure out what to do. And that was really good material to dwell on, because I knew what it was like.
What's the attraction of exploring that feeling through a work of fiction rather than through, I don't know, a memoir or an essay or a polemic?
I'm not old enough for memoirs. I'll give that another 30 years, please. But fiction is about investigating what life is like and sort of digging your way down into some kind of truth about life as such. It would be incredibly boring if this book was about me, because my life is not that interesting. But what the writer does is that we take this material and we lift it up to a level where it mirrors other people.
Does it need a certain kind of bravery to use elements of your own life in your fiction?
Yes, and I do think it does. I'm not scared of it anymore, but the first time I did it, it was like bungee jumping. It was like, can I actually do this? I, of course, protect people that I know. I mean, I cover up stuff, so it's not like I flaunt other people. But I also at one point thought, well, I don't think people are that different. I mean, most people are probably thinking stuff like I think, feeling stuff that I feel. So what's there to be ashamed about? I mean, we're all pretty much alike.
So that gave you the permission, as it were, to put it out there.
Yes, and I also tried writing material that was pretty to the core and sort of testing it one by one, smaller texts that I sort of let into the world, and found out that nothing happens. It's not that dangerous.
This is the collection of short fiction, which is...
No. I wrote a book called Days that has not been translated. It's been translated to English and it's out in America, but it's not out on the British market. But that was very close to home. And nothing happened from that. And people just mirrored it. And they just go, oh, I know what that feeling is like. And then, okay, so it's not that dangerous. As long as you remember to lift it up on another level.
We said that Sonia is stuck translating the crime fiction that it almost disgusts her. She's stuck in Copenhagen. She's stuck in stuck in the wrong gear. I'm wondering if that was partly why the book is constructed in this very circular, this very slow manner, almost in opposition to the narrative propulsion of crime fiction.
Yes. I like to write stories where almost nothing happens on the surface and where it's not structured over a certain kind of scheme that has to happen. And also you must remember that being a Danish writer means that you come from a strong tradition of minimalism. And the Danish language calls for minimalism, which is be subtle, tone it down. So there's a lot of stuff going on in this book, but it's not being screamed from the rooftops. It's like it's in between the lights. It's spoken in silence, and it's all dwelling beneath the sentences.
Do you share Sonia's distaste for Gustav Svensson's crime fiction, for the kind of grand guignol violence that is seen as entertainment by many readers?
I do like a very good crime novel. The problem is that when the Nordic noir wave hit the world, money came into the business, and it was as if some writers tried to overdo it and it became more and more perverted. We're so far from Agatha Christie and murdering people in a stylish way, and in a sort of cozy way. The Nordic crime novel became perverted, I would say. It was dwelling on sexual violence and decay and decomposition. Body bags, dead children, because you had to overdo it. I mean, it had to be worse than the last time.
It's kind of sensational effect.
Exactly. And when you do that to a genre, it sort of explodes in the end and, it's emptied of content in a certain way. But I do like the original crime fiction. Also, the crime fiction that is trying to figure out how society works and being critical towards political structures. And so.
The book, as you say, isn't structured in a kind of obvious kind of narrative thrust kind of way. There are images as well of helicopters, of whooper swans, of storms as a vast exchange between earth and sky returning through the book. Is this to capture the looping nature of Sonia's thoughts?
Yes, and also if you can't drive forward and you can't get forward and you can't turn back, these two directions are lost on you. But there is still one direction that is free, and that's upwards. That's where the helicopters and the swans and the imaginative and the free thought is. There's in one scene where Sonia is driving on the highway, and there is a truck in front of her, and there's a truck behind her. And she sits there scared to death, and she says that you can end up in a situation where the only way out is upwards. I mean, you can't get anywhere. And this is what happens to her when she can't move in real life. She can at least move in the landscape upwards, or she can look in the direction of the helicopters or the birds, and there's a free way out of it.
Your own career has had something of an unusual trajectory, publishing 4 novels in Denmark before finding immense success abroad with short stories in the US. How did that come about?
Oh, it's a fairy tale. the book was out in Denmark in 2008, and then I started translating one story at a time just for the fun of it, having them published in American magazines. Never had a story turned down, thought, oh, it's easy. So I just kept on going. And then at one point, 10 of these stories were translated and I got scouted and had a very good editor in New York. And what she did without me knowing it was that she sent some of my stories to The New Yorker. And The New Yorker picked up one of these stories, and I was the first Dane ever to be published in The New Yorker, and the rest is history.
What do you think it is about the stories that attracted your US readers?
I've been asked that a lot, and I think it's something about the American tradition of the short story. It's very strong over there. And then I figured out, actually in Los Angeles this summer, I was doing a reading, and I said that one of the most important things about the short story is presence. is that you're there on the beat and that you're very close to the person reading it, and there has to be a strong voice in it. And then a writer came up to me afterwards and said, the word presence, or the whole quality of presence, is like the key note in American literature. Because if you're not present, the American reader will drift. So it's also something with that kind of being in the moment and having your reader very close to you.
You said that you felt part of the Danish minimalist tradition. Is that notion of presence, is that also something that is in Danish letters?
Yes, I think the minimalist tradition calls for the reader to pay attention. That is one thing. I do think I differ. I was actually schooled in Swedish literature. I studied Swedish literature, which is why I'm so preoccupied with the existence, which that tradition is. And also, I'm very preoccupied with voice, that there is a very strong sense of a narrative voice behind the text, so that you feel you're in the company of an essence actually talking to you, which feels strong when you read it. And I don't think that is a big part of Danish minimalism. Danish minimalism, when it's really minimalist, can be completely blanked from that. It's sort of, that's not there. I think I got that from the Swedes.
Are your Danish readers now catching up with your success abroad? How does that feel?
Yes, of course. I mean, after the Karate Chop success in America and in the UK afterwards, Danes are reading that book, and I seem to pick up that there are more short stories being written in Denmark than there was like...
You've unleashed a wave.
Yes, because people sort of got curious about the whole thing again, and also other writers started feeling that it was okay to actually excel in that. And then, of course, this book has been read a lot, because in Denmark most people prefer novels to short stories, so...
Do you say that there are elements of Sonia's story which were drawn from your own life? Mm-hmm. Are you now thinking of using elements from this phase of your life where you've found this fantastical success in fiction?
I'm not a very practical writer. I don't plan what I write. So one day I'll probably be sitting in the dunes of Western Jutland where I live, looking at the sky, and I'll probably write down a chapter and I'll go, is that interesting? Can I hang out in this story for a year or two? And then I'll work on it. But I don't know what it's going to be, because I write as if I'm reading it myself. So I never know what's going to happen. But most likely, I will, as always, donate stuff from my own life to give it life.
I'm wondering if literature has a problem with happiness, with success.
You mean the writing of it, or the culture surrounding literature, or actually writing and being in the process of writing it?
I'm wondering if it's difficult for literary fiction in particular to deal with a story in which the characters are finding success and happiness.
If it is a difficult story, I ought to write it, because then it would be interesting. I mean, I never felt that it was difficult to write after I had the international breakthrough. On the contrary, I felt like finally there's somebody out there who's going to read this book, so now I can just pour. Never felt pressure when it happened, just relief and joy. That doesn't mean that my literature is becoming, hippie, happy. not at all. But it's just, it's sort of a creative relief that there's... Because literature is about communication. It's about reaching people, talking to them. And if there's nobody reading your books, it seems kind of pointless. And having a breakthrough means they're actually there. So it's not like life itself has become happy, but the creative process has become.
Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianBooks to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Richard there interviewing Daughter Knows. Mirror Shoulder Signal is published by Pushkin. Richard is with us now, along with Daniel Hahn, who, as I previously said, was on the panel that selected the long list. Daniel, Daughter is one of only three women. You knew that you'd get the woman question, didn't you?
I did know I'd get the woman question. It's a problem that we sort of knew was going to happen, because one of the things that the long list gives some indication of is which books are submitted, and the books that are submitted give some indication of which books are being published. We know that there is a big problem in the gender balance of the of the writers whose books are translated into English, only between a quarter and a third of the books translated into English are by women writers. So it's a fairly common problem when you get to a long list or a short list of a prize like the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize in the past or the Man Booker International Prize now, that women are very badly represented. A lot of what you see in the long list, a lot of the perceived imbalances, which may be linguistic, which may be geographical, and certainly in terms of the gender of the author, are a reflection of problems we have in publishing today, which favours a certain kind of translation.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, though. If you look at the translators, and this is a prize for writer and translator,
six of the
13. Translators are much more skewed towards female.
Yes, and that's sort of normal. I think it's six of the 13 translators are women. And that's something which we found, again, with the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, which ran for about 20 years. It was the kind of equivalent prize of this until 2 years ago. Of the 20 books that won, only two of them were written by women. But they were about half and half. The winning translators were about half and half women to men, which is a much better representation of what the translation profession looks like. But there is some kind of block, there is some kind of skew in what actually gets chosen for translation into English from writers in other languages.
Richard, what did you think of this list?
Well, there are some familiar names and it's an unfamiliar names, which I think is kind of the point of this kind of list. It's terrific. I mean, we've seen there's books from David Grossman and from Amos Oz. There's Ismail Kadari, who was the first winner of the Man Booker International back
when it was a life's work.
Exactly, when it was a kind of lifetime achievement award. And now he's back with a novel which was first published in 1978, The Traitor's Niche, which takes us back to 19th century Albania, which is part of a trilogy which was published before he left for Paris in 1990, a third of which was banned. But there are a couple of other names on the list that struck me. The first is a friend of the site, if I can put him that way, Alan Mabonkou, who did a story for us a little while back as part of one of our fiction projects, who's back in Congo Brazzaville with a novel, Black Moses. And one of the things I think which is so great about his writing is the voice. I mean, he's talked on this podcast before about writing French with an African accent, and Helen Stevenson does a great job of getting that Africanness into her version. It's marvellous to hear the way she does that in his work. And the other one that struck me was Clemens Meyer, who again is another writer. We ran a story of his a little while back of Dogs and Horses, which was terrific, marvellous story, as part of our project to commemorate the Berlin Wall. And this is his first novel, I believe. Is that right, Daniel?
I think so. He's published in English before. He has a collection of short stories in English before called All the Lights, published a few years ago.
Yes, but this is a first novel, which I'm looking forward to reading as well. But one of the things that, looking down the list, one of the things that struck me was there are quite a few of these writers are quite international in a sense. They start from one place and move elsewhere. And I'm wondering if that's something that is, with literary fiction, is so hard to make a kind of living, as it were, out of being a literary fiction writer. I'm wondering if that's something whereby there's a kind of another sort of writing, which is writers who have managed to reach kind of global audience.
So what you mean is Mabonkou is actually from Congo, but now lives in France and is down as a French writer. Is that what you mean?
He lives in California.
He's in LA.
He lives in California.
He's French. He's the kind of French candidate, if you like, on the list with Mathias Inar. But he lives in California. So he is, as Richard said, one of those many writers who has more than one home or more than one identity. And I think it's partly to do with the way people write now, but it's also to do with the way people think about writers. One of the things that determines if you're a success as a writer is if you're an international success. And actually, I think that's one of the reasons that the Man Booker International Prize is so important, that it's a kind of validation of a certain kind of writer who often will be translated into many languages, but it takes quite a while to get to English because we still have this sort of resistance to translating international fiction. And it is, I think, increasingly important for writers of very good fiction that they're recognised not just within their own parish, but actually seen in other languages and in other countries.
I guess the thing that interests me about that as well is whether there's a different style of writing or a different sort of writing which is in some way creating a global literature.
I suspect there is, though I would hope there isn't. I mean, I think it's one of the things that when you're reading, you kind of try and guard against. One of the things that we talked about when we were looking at the books that were kind of coming into contention for the long list, when we were kind of fairly close to deciding, was to what extent we were expecting particular things from these books. Whether, for example, we think a Chinese novel ought to be doing a certain thing, and therefore it should be playing to a particular expectation of what a globalization novel looks like, where there is certain ways of telling stories. And in a prize like this, it's very difficult, actually, because you're comparing novels from lots and lots of different countries that actually have lots and lots of different traditions and lots of different pedigrees. And to expect them to be, if I can put it like this, to expect them to be good in the same way is going to be doing a disservice to some or others. So in one sense, we're kind of resisting, we're trying to resist the idea that everyone is kind of flowing into this slightly kind of globish writing, you know.
Yeah, one of the things that Ota Noors talked about just now was about how she found success, or a new level of success, you might say, after publishing short fiction in the New Yorker. Yeah, but one of the things I think that she does so very well is that this book is very much of its place. And I guess that's one way in which they can all be, in some sense, measurable. Do they achieve this spirit of being of a place equally well?
Well, a lot of it is to do with what you said when you were describing Dorset's book first, which is to do with voice. The specificity you get isn't the Danish landscape or the Danish cityscape. What you get is the feeling of being in the mind of a very particular person in a very particular moment in her life with very particular relationships and problems and senses of humour and those things. And so it doesn't feel generic, but it's not because it feels like a more Danish novel than the other ones on the list. It's because it feels like there is an actual person there who is alive and distinct.
Now, there are some countries here or cultures that are not very familiar to us. For example, you've got a Belgian novelist who writes in, he's Flemish, and we're more used to the Wallon, aren't we, the French Belgians.
So yes, there's a very fine Flemish novel by a writer called Stefan Hertmant called War and Turpentine, who writes in Flemish. There's one of a very large number of books that were submitted in Flemish or Dutch. One of the things that's interesting when you're looking at the submissions for these is kind of comparing the kind of balance just of the submissions, because there are some cultures that are very well represented. And it's partly to do with there being very good writing, but it's also to do with things like the Flemish Literature Fund is a very active and very generous promoter of Flemish literature. So it's much easier for a Flemish writer or a Dutch writer to get translated into English. And you end up with a submissions list in which we have more or less the same number of books submitted from, for example, Flemish and Dutch, as we get from all of the rest of Asia. Those numbers are almost identical. And so you end up with someone like Hertmans, who is a great, if you like, representative of that kind of flowering of very well-supported Dutch-Flemish literature. But actually, there were lots and lots of Dutch novels and other Flemish novels that might have been in contention.
Last year, Han Kang won it with The Vegetarian, Korean. But there are notably few Asian writers on this list. Why is that?
There's one Asian writer on the long list now, who's Yan Liangke, with a brilliant and wild satirical novel called The Explosion Chronicles. We had very few Asian submissions this year. There were a few from, I think there were three from Korea. There was one from Thailand. There were a couple from India. There was a little spread of them, but just the numbers are very, very low. There are a number of, I think, structural problems in getting books from Asian languages into English, partly to do with the availability of really experienced translators, but a lot of it's to do with funding as well.
Korea puts loads of money in.
Korea does fund, which is why there were at least three Korean novels submitted this year. The translator winner of last year's prize, Deborah Smith, who translated The Vegetarian, has since winning set up her own press, which is called Tilted Axis Press, the aim of which is to publish fiction translated from less represented Asian languages. So in fact, her first three books are from Korea, Bangla, and from Thai.
There are two Israelis. Is that contentious? I mean, they are possibly the best-known writers on this list, aren't they? David Grossman and Amos Oz.
I don't think it's contentious, or at least if it's contentious, that's sort of irrelevant to what we were doing. We made our list and we looked at the 13 when we'd chosen them and went, isn't it interesting that we have two from this small press, Fitzcarraldo, and we only have three by women, but we do have two from Israel, but we don't have any from, you know, wherever.
Two from Israel and one from Latin America.
One from Latin America, one from Asia, two from Israel, and one from Africa, and then a lot of Europe, as you would expect. It just happened, and it was, I think, very fortunate for us. It happened that Grossman and Oz had books out the same year. Oz, I think, hasn't published a novel in about a decade. Grossman has been more regular. But they were two of the best books we read. And there was no way we were going to, in our conversation, go, well, we've already got someone in the, you know, the Israeli slot, and so we have to put someone else here. It's curious that Israel is, in fact, the only country, unless you include Mabonko in France, Israel is the only country with more than one writer, and Hebrew and French are the only two languages with more than one book. But they were two of the 13 best books we read.
It's all about the money in that case, isn't it? It's all about the support that these writers are getting from their home countries. And it's all about the figures as that filters through to your submissions process. And then after that, I suppose you have to take an honest opinion.
There is another point, though, isn't there, about Asia, which is that a lot of Asians, I mean, particularly the Indian subcontinent, write in English anyway, therefore would not be eligible for this award.
So there is a lot of Indian writing in English, that's true.
And Pakistani.
and Pakistani writing, which is not to say that there isn't a huge amount in other languages, but I think one of the problems we have is that the writing in English does slightly obscure the other stuff. And there was, until relatively recently, I think, an assumption among publishers, among readers, among I'm not sure who, that if we wanted, you know, really good fiction from India, there was plenty we could read in English. We didn't have to worry about this other stuff. But actually, we're talking about huge numbers of people who are writing in other languages. There were some very fine Indian novels in translation submitted. But it's interesting that I think the year I judged the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, which was 6 or 7 years ago, we shortlisted a novel written in Bangla. It was called Charangi by Shankar, translated by Arunava Sinha, which I believe was not only the first Bangla novel shortlisted for the Indie, I believe it was the first Bangla novel ever submitted for the Indie. And this, the prize had been going for about 15 years at that point. And you think about the kind of disconnect between the number of people who speak in and write in this language and actually the lack of access to an English language readership. And in a way, the English language writers in the subcontinent are partly the problem, in fact.
And one has to remember that the English language market is the global market, isn't it? The biggest market.
It is, but the English language market itself is not quite as, the bits of it are not quite as porous as you'd expect. There are, in fact, plenty of writers in India who write in other languages who are translated into English in India and who are published by Penguin India and HarperCollins India and whoever else in India and never make it to the English language markets beyond the subcontinent.
Right, I'm going to now park the Man Booker International and move on to Aarhus 39, which is there are two anthologies of writing for children and young adults by the 39 best European writers under 40. Tell us about this project.
So this is a project which is a partnership really between the Hay Festival and Aarhus 2017. Aarhus, the second city of Denmark, is the European Capital of Culture this year, and they have a very wide-ranging cultural program running right the way through the year. And they started a conversation with the Hay Festival about how they could celebrate literature, in particular literature for children and teenagers, and do it in a way that felt very European. And so the idea was selecting 39 writers for children and young people from right the way across Europe to represent a kind of generation. Hay have done this before with the Beirut 39 and the Bogota 39 and the Africa 39. So this is the latest in a kind of ongoing project. And all of these writers are, as you say, being collected in an anthology. They're all going to come together to Aarhus in October for a big children's writing festival and a number of other events that are going to be going on through the year.
When you launched it at the London Book Fair, you were talking about the differences in writing cultures. And since we're having a bit of a Danish theme this week, tell us about the particular challenge of Denmark.
Well, it's interesting because we're publishing these anthologies. There are two separate publications of these anthologies. They're being published in the UK by Alma Books, and they've been published by a Danish publisher in parallel at the same time. And so I've been editing this collection for the UK publishers and then sending the stories as edited and sending my notes to the Danish publishers for them to use. And we have had various cases where it's become quite clear that what we expect from a children's story or what we expect from a teenage story is quite different from what the Danes expect. There was one instance where I was sent a story which I read and I wrote back to the author and said, I think this is a brilliant story, but that scene on page 4, there is just no way we can put this in an anthology that's going to be read by 12-year-olds. And she spoke to the Danish publisher who wrote to me and said, we have no problem putting this in a collection that's going to be read by a 12-year-old at all. There were, in fact, some things that went the other way as well. And I was quite surprised that when we started thinking about which of these stories were going to fit in the teenage anthology and which were going to fit in the children's anthology, we both had stories that we would have moved in one direction or the other. But it's also interesting, I think, because as someone who works quite a lot with children's books in this country, I don't think we really examine those things that are just, that we kind of take for granted. Of course, if I'd thought about it, I would have known that the things that we think are acceptable for children and teenagers are, of course, culturally defined. But you don't really think about that until what is culturally defined by you comes into friction with somebody else's.
Next week, we have a special treat lined up. George Saunders is coming in to talk about his immense new work, Lincoln in the Bardo, and how President Lincoln's own personal bardo, his intermediate state, as the Buddhists might put it, sheds an interesting light on the present times with President Trump. We'll also be giving our verdict on the shortlist of this year's Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this podcast, why not listen in to another of the great programmes our audio team are putting out? This month we're featuring Token, a series tackling all those issues you thought were too touchy to raise. One episode, for instance, addresses the question, why is black hair a thing? Another investigates the statement, I got a job because I'm Asian. To listen or to quarrel, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts. which is where you'll find us too by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. You can track us down at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead.
And from me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian, the ever silent one. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.